Hello, hello, hello. Hello, Georgians, hello, global citizens, and hello, concerned Americans. My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the current co-host of the Politician Podcast, which myself and my high school best friend Damian Galvin created in June of this year to talk about issues that interest us, issues that disgust us, and issues that America needs to know about. In other words, myself and Damian created this podcast to deconstruct public policy issues of the past and the present and create a more equitable future for all of us. We have a very, very special episode queued up for you guys, but before we play this episode, we're going to give a special thank you to our sponsor, Patreon, and our wonderful team here at Politician, which includes high school juniors Jada Pilling, Yi Shen, and Julia Hartman. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we hope that you enjoy. See you in the episode.
And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Politician. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. My name is Varun Kadathala. I am the co-host of the Politician Podcast. And today for our episode, we have a very special host, I guess a platter of just guests on our podcast today. We have two guests, our first four-person episode, Damian, which is absolutely insane. You know, it's been a couple of months. I think 4 months is coming on to 4 months now for our podcast. So it's incredible to have four guests finally on our podcast, hopefully even more. But today we have two people. Number one, they're both our friends from high school, Brad Lish and Tarun Ramanathan. Now, to introduce themselves, I want to give Tarun a chance to kind of talk about himself and then Brad a chance to just talk about himself and why he's on the podcast today and just his background. So without further ado, I guess I want to let you speak about yourself, Tarun.
All right. Hello, guys. My name is Tarun, and I'm really excited to be on this podcast. I really want to discuss the important issues that have been going on lately, like the presidential town halls and the Supreme Court hearings and many other issues that pertain to politics that have occurred this week.
Absolutely. You know, this week has been a roller coaster, as we all know, as the last couple of weeks have been, as the last couple of years has been. So it's incredible to see how much we have to talk about today. And to introduce himself, we have Brad Lish, our fourth guest on the podcast today.
What's going on, guys? My name is Brad, and I'm super excited to come on today. I'm so proud of you guys for starting up this podcast and what you guys have done so far. But I lean towards conservative, and I'm Republican, so I'm super super excited to discuss my views and current events with you guys. And yeah.
And then speaking about discussing our views and current events, Varun, you know, before the podcast starts for our listeners, we kind of talk a little bit beforehand, but we'd never want to give too much away. But I wanted to talk about this especially. You know who's the worst worst people to talk about politics with?
Who's that?
Politicians. It's like, I love when we're recording the podcast, I love just having either me and you on, like I love having guests on, don't get me wrong. And it's amazing right. to have all these amazing guests on. But I think I have the most fun and I look forward to the podcast the most when we're having comedians on, when we're having, would say even politicians that aren't generally politicians, because there's, you know, there's the Washington, I guess, politicians, if that's what you call them. Yeah. What's the thing? What's the term that Donald Trump refers to?
You know what's
to?
Important? Politically correct is what he uses.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, and I think it's true to an extent, because these people have to be politically correct for their jobs and their re-election campaigns. They have ties to being politically correct. So I think that sometimes it dilutes what they say, and in some circumstances, they're not entirely truthful.
And it's scary.
I think that having, you know, down-to-earth people like, you know, Brad Tarun, just our friends on, who aren't tied to these campaigns and re-election campaigns on is awesome. You know,
yeah.
it's obviously
and
awesome.
And it is nerve-wracking sometimes to have people like Matt Lieberman on the podcast where it's like,
absolutely,
your dad ran for vice president. Like, that's crazy. So it's like you're asking them questions and you're like, what if I ask a wrong question? Where it's like you have a comedian on, like Blair Erskine. Blair Erskine was one of my favorite episodes. I don't even know if it's the politician necessarily, but like I see that there's just different people. Like, there's different types of politicians. I think it even goes to a stark comparison with our education kind of professionals that we've had on the podcast, where we had Neil Lester and we also had Dr. Ronald Mason. And it's like the episode with Dr. Ronald Mason, I think, was more on the serious end, more so than with Dr. Neil Lester. But I mean, it was so much, both of them were so much fun, like just on a basis. But regardless, I'm excited to have, once again, like you said, two guests that we can kind of just talk without worrying about our political affiliations. And I guess just have a genuine conversation about. We have some crazy guests coming up. We usually preface this at the end of the episode, but now that we're talking about these comedians and stuff, we're hoping on having, well, we do have it scheduled, actually. It's Zach Borstein, if I'm not mistaken, correct, Rune?
Yeah, the 21st is Zach Borstein. He's a comedian, yeah. Part of multiple shows, including Saturday Night Live. So a very influential person, but I don't want to take up too much time from the podcast itself. That's an amazing episode coming up for you guys. I think it's going to be out 2 days after that, maybe that Friday. I'm not sure. But anyways, the 21st is when we're recording that, so an amazing opportunity. We'll get you guys some more information about that after the episode today. But I did want to segue into the topic of today's podcast, which is the presidential, I guess, well, it should have been a debate, but this, not the debate, but the town hall with two candidates. But this time, people had to watch both candidates from two different platforms. Joe Biden was airing his town hall on ABC with voters, and Donald Trump was airing his town hall, the president, on NBC, I think MSNBC, and one other platform. I forget which one it was. But anyways, they both were pretty good town halls, but different town halls, radically different. I want to talk about that difference with Savannah Guthrie and with both, you know, Stephen Papadopoulos, I believe, from ABC News, getting Joe Biden's thing up, and Savannah Guthrie on Trump's town hall. So I want to talk about this with the both of you. First, I want to ask Brad, what do you think was the difference, if there was a difference, between both moderators in the town halls? Like, what do you think really defined, how are they different, and how did this impact, you know, the candidates' own responses?
I definitely think there was a difference between these moderators. Stephanopoulos, the moderator for Biden's town hall, you know, I really felt like he wasn't going in on Biden as much as Savannah Guthrie was. Like, let's say Biden was to make a claim and, you know, it could be anything. And Stephanopoulos really just wouldn't, you know, counter that or add to it as much as, you know, Savannah would. So Trump, I think, was mostly debating with Savannah the entire time. You know, the first 20 minutes of the hour was Trump and Savannah just talking. And throughout the debate, Savannah would just go on rampants with Trump. And, you know, I just felt like it just didn't leave enough time for the voters to ask their questions. But for Biden's debate, the moderator was good for Stephanopoulos, did very good, in my opinion. But, I do think there was a difference between them.
So, yeah, you know, a great point. I want to ask this to, I think, I want to ask this to Tarun. First of all, I want to let you, first of all, address this claim. What do you think about, you know, both the debates or town halls and how the moderators handled them? And was there a big difference, what, in your opinion?
I would tend to agree with Brad on this for, like, a couple reasons, right? If you noticed in Donald Trump's town hall, Savannah, she was extremely assertive compared to Stephanopoulos. If you notice, she was consistently fact-checking him, but I do not necessarily think that this was a bad thing, because a lot of the times Trump might have brought up like a false claim or something like that, and Savannah would just hammer home on that claim. And I'd say this was necessary for a couple of the questions, but the moderator for Joe Biden's town hall was definitely less strict and more lenient with Joe Biden and allowed voters to ask him more questions. So I agree mostly with Brad on this point.
Right. Well, you hit my kind of point on the ball. I was going to ask you about fact-checking and whether that's important. And you hit that right on the ball. I think that it's good. Yeah. But I guess I wanted to ask you, Damien, honestly, the same question. And also, beyond that, do you think that fact-checking is important in this kind of setting, because I know that the debate commission doesn't allow for follow-up questions. And that's the reason for why, you know, the first two presidential debates were a little bit less of this confrontational format that Savannah Guthrie took. Do you think that this is what we're looking for in a type of, you know, town hall or debate setting, or is this something that you don't want to, you know, have in the future?
Well, first and foremost, I want to say that I agree and disagree with both perspectives, respectively. The reason being that there was not a difference, I believe, in the moderators. Obviously, there were different moderators, but more so there was a difference in the candidates. Donald Trump is not proficient at answering difficult questions. He's not proficient typically at answering questions in general. And you know, when you have a politic that has been politicking for 47 years in Joe Biden, you can understand to a certain respect why. But there were certain questions, like something that we'll definitely discuss later, the question about QAnon, which has, you know, that's a tough question. When, you know, you compare that to a tough question that Biden got, which was, let's see, the 1994 crime bill.
Court packing. Yeah.
Court packing, 94 crime bill. Both of those he gave genuine responses to. I even think with the court packing, I have disagreed with Biden's stance on it in the past. But I think that he gave us a response that was genuine. And I think that it's not fair to ask, will you pack the court before the Supreme Court justice that is going to be unfairly put into the position that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was previously in. It's unfair to ask him that, right? When I think she would say it best is you're asking him a hypothetical situation. He first has to examine all the evidence that she may answer to senators multiple times. But beyond that, I want to refrain back and say that or refer back to the fact that I was mentioning that their politics, they have different stance to their politics, and they're two different people up there. They're two different politicians up there. And that's the difference. Not so much so the moderators. When you have someone that is up there that constantly is lying and has to be fact checked, and I'm not even, you can fact check me. The president lies more on average than any other president in U.S. history, and more than Joe Biden lies. That's just period. That's not something that it's a matter of opinion. I think I wouldn't be able to tell you the direct stats, but it's something in about like in. I wouldn't be able to give you exact numbers, but the president lies substantially more. I have this number 2,000, but I don't know the ratio in which that is to. It might be 2,000 lies per hour. But again, I wouldn't know the ratio that's to, so it would be unfair for me to say that. But you have to have the president being fact-checked. And if he's not answering the questions and he's not answering them fairly, then as the president of the United States and as the job of the press is to, you know, put these people in positions of power and hold them responsible. So just to reiterate one more time, it wasn't so much so the moderators, but rather the people that were on the stage with the moderators.
Yeah. And I'm going to open floor to more discussion just right after one point. I wanted to mention this to elaborate on Damien's point. I think that one pattern that I've seen in the way that the president phrases what he's saying is that in making claims, when contested, he always says, and almost always he does this, he says, somebody told me, I believe that. You know, he told me, she told me, but who told you, Mr. President? That's what Savannah Guthrie asked President Donald Trump, you know, yesterday during the town hall. Because one pattern is that he continually brings up these people who he never names these people. And Savannah Guthrie was like, you know, who is this person? Who were you trying, you know, who'd you get this information from? And his answer was, you know, I don't know, but I trust them, right? I trust them. And that's the kind of blind trust that she exposed. Now, I wanted to kind of go back on Damien's point and say that I think the biggest difference was in the way that the candidates substantiated their claims. Whereas you had Joe Biden coming out, for the most part, watching the debate itself, he highlighted the facts and the evidence behind the issues. Whereas President Trump, when asked and asked about the facts and the evidence behind what he said, he said, somebody said this, somebody said that. But I wanted to kind of go back onto the question of court packing, because I know that Biden mentioned this. One of the toughest questions, guys, of the night was about court packing. And Biden didn't get many tough questions. I'll tell you that. I agree with you. But one of the tough questions was on court packing. And, you know, Stephanopoulos asked him, I believe it's Stephanopoulos, asked him from ABC News, you know, do you support court packing? And he said, well, based upon my own viewpoints, I don't. However, in this election, I may have to, because, you know, the process of appointing Amy Coney Barrett may be flawed. And he said that I will make that decision closer to the time after the, you know, hearings and evaluating it for myself. But he did say one thing, which I want our viewers to take away. Mm-hmm. He would provide a standpoint before the election to inform the viewers. And guys, it's a radical shift from what we saw before. So I guess I wanted to open the floor. You guys can talk about this. I want to hear what you guys have to say about that question itself, you know, Amy Coney Barrett's nominations, anything about that?
Absolutely. I'm just to start, I think before anything else is said, I think Joe Biden did receive a lot of tough questions. I just don't think that they're highlighted as tough when he knows how to respond to them. I think that they equally get difficult questions, but again, it goes back to that idea that some people can just make things look effortless, and I don't think that Donald Trump is one of those people that can make questions and his responses look effortless, which I don't necessarily say is a bad thing or a good thing. It's a bad thing if you're going to talk about it in terms of the media, but I'm sure that his base appreciates that about him, the fact that he's not good at answering questions. But with that being said, I think that it's fair. I think that it's fair, right? Because the response by, I'm not going to say conservatives, and I'm not going to say Republicans, because the Republican Party right now is not what the Republican Party is, and being a conservative is not what it means to be a conservative today. It's not what it meant to be. It's not what it was when you were a conservative under the Bush or Reagan administration.
It is a bleak reality, Damian.
Yeah, but with that being said, current Trumponian Republicans point to the fact that that we will break precedent. Oh, we've had 9 justices in the Supreme Court since blah, blah, blah. What about the fact that since the United States started, we have not added a Supreme Court justice in the final term of a president? How about the fact that in 2016, they promised to keep that president regardless of what president was sitting in office, whether their affiliations were blue or red? What about the fact that, again, the person leading these questioning and the commission on adding the Supreme Court justice himself stated that you can mark my words, you know, hold the tape, use my what I'm saying against me. If there is a Republican in office, if Donald Trump wins in 2020 and it is the last year of his first term, we will not appoint a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, that's for all of our viewers. That's Lindsey Graham, the guy in a tough race against Jamie Harrison in South Carolina.
Exactly, a tough race that he, because of the fact that he has failed to stand by the American value and the American principle of precedent, which is so important, is, I think, going to cost him his election. But that's neither here nor there. If you're going to attack Joe Biden for not following precedent, you want to look at yourself in the mirror first. And I don't, you know, I hate the idea that, oh, they're doing it, so I'm going to do it too. I don't think that Joe Biden should do it. I think that we should be the bigger person and wait. But I think that it's not a fair argument to say that that he shouldn't do it because of precedent. But I'd like Brad personally to respond to that, because I know that he probably does have something to say.
So on the idea of court packing, I just believe it is the right of the president to do that, and the president needs to fulfill his duties. And as President Trump said himself, and presidents are elected for 4 years, and in those 4 years, they have to fufill their duties. They're not elected for 3.5; they're elected for 4. And when there's a vacancy in the Supreme Court, you have to fill that vacancy. That's fulfilling your duties.
Right. So, and I want to, yeah,
go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, right. I didn't hear your ending point there.
No. So, going back on the court packing and Joe Biden going against it, or saying that he's against it and he's going to release something before the election, I feel is kind of hypocritical. Joe Biden's stance on the court packing was people are already voting, so you should not go through the nomination. But then last night he says that he's going to release his official opinion further before the election, but earlier he said people are already voting, so it doesn't matter.
Okay.
I think that, to be honest with you, I want to let Tarun speak, but I want to begin by this. I think that, in my opinion, well, actually, I'm going to let my opinion wait. I want to let Trent speak.
Absolutely. I have a lot to add on. So first, I want to talk about court packing. I fundamentally disagree with what Brad said. I don't necessarily think it's the president's duty to like have to do this in like the last like what 3 weeks of the election.
35 days.
Yeah. Okay. Last 35 days of the election. I'm personally against court packing because I think it contributes a lot to like the polarization of our country, and I think it's a really bad idea. And piggybacking off of this, I want to talk about like two patterns I noticed in each town hall. So first, let's look at like Biden's town hall, right, where he answered the question about court packing. What I do really appreciate about Joe Biden is he was really honest throughout the entire town hall. So what I noticed is like in every question, he gave like a super concrete response, even though sometimes it might have been a bit vague. It was extremely concrete, and he was extremely organized in all of his responses. Like he gave lists like number one, number two of like every single policy that he was going to enact. Yep. A couple of things I noticed with Trump is his attitude was extremely aggressive when he didn't really know how to answer a question. And I noticed that throughout the entire debate, he was showing a lot of attitude. And I noticed there was also a lot of deflection. For example, when he was asked to condemn white supremacy, although he did condemn white supremacy, he spent way more time talking about like Antifa or the left or deflecting to some other topic. And those are a lot of things that I noticed during both of the town halls. And I just wanted to get my thoughts about that out too.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I couldn't let slide though was this quote coming from Brad. You aren't elected for 3 years, you're elected for four. And I think that that was an important thing to come back on because we have to mention once again the fact that Obama's Supreme Court nominee was not even put on the Senate floor to be voted on. What is the distinction here, Brad? Why is there this position of you're not elected for 3 years for the Republican president, but there's this distinction of you can't make a pick in your last term for the Democratic president.
I guess to consolidate it, I would just ask you, Brad, was Obama also elected for 4 years?
No, I completely agree with what you're saying. I, in my opinion, believe Obama should have gone through with the nomination, and I feel Trump should do the same. So Last term for Obama, I believe he should have appointed the justice.
Yeah, the difficulty here is the fact that the Senate did not think so, and the Senate quoted the fact that in the last year, no president should elect their justice. So if we're going to follow the precedent of the Senate, I agree with you completely. Donald Trump, I think it would be more of a courtesy thing. And I think that if he had a higher approval rating, that it kind of be like, look, I'm going to let the American people decide, you know, who's going to be the next Supreme Court justice, knowing at the end of the day that he's going to win. Right now, he's losing substantially. And we can say the same thing's going to happen as 2016. But right now, people are mad and people are voting. And if you can vote, go out and vote. I think the most amazing thing that we were told, I think that it was by Jennifer Kavanaugh, if I'm not mistaken, Varun. It was the fact that if every young person that was eligible to vote would vote, that every state but Utah would be blue. And it's just this idea that's like absolutely insane. But that's neither here nor there, and I'm not saying that that's a good thing or a bad thing. But it just shows kind of this distinction in who's politically active. But nonetheless, the Senate has set the precedent that the president cannot put forth their nominee in 4 years or in their fourth year of their first or second term. So again, it comes back to this idea: would it not be fair that Donald Trump does not get to make his pick, or why has your party? Because I'm assuming that you still affiliate as Republican. Why has your party decided that there's a double standard when, you know, Donald Trump is in office compared to when Joe Biden I guess Joe Biden was in office, but when Obama was in office?
I honestly am not too sure on why they're going back on their word. I do believe that the Republicans, once again, should not have done that back in 2016. In that, you know, the Senate should have allowed the judge appointed or appointee to go through. So I believe the shift is definitely in the approval rating for Trump. I do believe the Senate and Trump are worried about the reelection and that they do want this nomination to go through. If Donald Trump was like certain that he was going to get reelected, I agree with you. He would not be rushing this.
Exactly.
So I do agree with you on that.
Yeah. And I
want to, Damien, I want to shift.
Yeah,
the
go
opinion.
Ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I just want to let, first of all, Tarun speak on this topic, but before I wanted to kind of give my take on this, and my take is very formulaic. It is the fact that if this president, Donald Trump, believed he would win, which he's down by almost 10 points, even more than 10 points in some states, has a 13 out of 100 chance of winning as per 538 polls, which I believe. If he thought he was going to win, he would wait for the next term to appoint this justice and not rush this out. However, I think this is completely based on the assumption that he's not going to win next year, because this creates the kind of urgency to appoint this justice, to pack the courts. And the only reason which I see this happening is the Republicans wanting to secure legislature from the bench, to adjudicate from the bench and create laws for the people from the bench in the case that they lose the Senate, the House, and the presidency. Because there, they really don't have a presence. And I think they want to cement that. Now, that's my standpoint. I want to continue by also saying that, Brad, since this happened in 2016, there's effects. There's consequences. We have a Republican majority court right now. You know, it's incredible how many Republicans we have, and we can have even more right now. And what this does is it creates ability to create compromise. And that's an issue. Now, back in 2016, if we let Merrick Garland come onto the court, we would have had a much more uniform court. But going into right now, the problem is that the justices are invariably to the right. And that, for progressives, it risks, you know, reproductive rights, healthcare rights. You know, first Roe v. Wade, things like this are incredibly at risk right now with this court. So I think that right now, Joe Biden has to understand that by not packing the courts, he's not just sitting back and saying, well, we're not going to be petty. We're not going to do it just because they did it. I think that at this point, if you don't do it, you're sitting back. Because if they appoint Amy Coney Barrett, in my opinion, you are sitting back by not packing the courts. And you're saying that is okay. You're allowing it to happen. Yep. The problem is, back in 2016, that was not okay. Right now, as per that precedent, that is not okay, in my opinion. And I want to go back on this point. I do not think that Amy Coney Barrett is a bad person.
Neither do I. Yeah.
And I want to stick by that, because throughout the entire hearing, the Republicans had an incredibly good hearing. But I'm talking about unobstructed hearing.
I think she had a horrible hearing.
I'm going to stick by this. I want to say that she had a very unobstructed hearing.
I agree
with
that.
We heard her stances. We heard
I disagree with that.
We heard empathy. But the problem is that I didn't want to listen to the entire thing, because every single time I saw her, I was like, this is an illegitimate person.
Yeah.
I want to let Tarun speak on the whole situation.
Yeah.
Because right. I know that you have some things to say.
I want to ask Tarun something in specific, though. Do you think, respond to the whole situation, but do you think that the rest of the Supreme Court justices might see her as illegitimate? And how might that affect kind of the Supreme Court and the polarization in it?
I don't necessarily think that the entire Supreme Court is going to see her as illegitimate, because then again, like, you know, six of them are conservatives, right? After like, and only three of them are like other party or other have other affiliations. So what I do think is like by adding like Amy Coney Barrett, I don't necessarily think that like the rest of the court is going to see her as illegitimate, but I definitely do think that a lot of the American citizens, or like a lot of the people in the government in general, will see her as illegitimate. And my take on the whole situation is a lot of it depends on like the political climate of America, right? So Donald Trump currently has a like pretty low approval rating. So if he was like really confident that he was going to like win the election, then he wouldn't be rushing to get her in court this quickly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, what I do think about the situation is, because of the political climate currently, I don't think it's a great idea, because of the fact that like it would be totally different if he had like a 65% approval rating and he was almost like sure to get reelected. It would be completely different in that scenario. And I don't think nearly as many people would be this like mad about this or this like shocked that this is going to happen. So I think most of this, like my opinion on this, just relies on the political climate. And now, since the political climate is very polarized, obviously, I don't think it's a good idea.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Number one. Tarun, you brought up a really good point. You brought up the perspective that they're rushing this. And the problem is that they're rushing this nomination more than they are rushing funding for the American people, that stimulus package. They're rushing it more than they are rushing criminal justice reform. They're rushing it more than they're rushing police reform. This is things they're sitting back on, and they're using it for political motives. And I think that that is so immoral, in my opinion. But I wanted to ask Brad this, in the spirit of just creating conversation. Is it the president's responsibility to tell the American people what his stance is, or a candidate's responsibility to tell the American people what his stance is on his or her stances on court packing, when it's not the president's duty to, you know, even adjudicate on court packing, because that is Congress's ability? So why would it be, in your opinion, a president's responsibility to detail his viewpoints when it's independently Congress's?
I believe it's important because the president obviously has a lot of influence on their party as well. So if, you know, there's a Republican president and a Republican Senate, they can easily, or a Republican Congress, they can easily, you know, pack the courts, or a Democrat president and a Democrat Congress, they can easily do that. And, you know, with the word from the president and the support from the party, these congressmen would. And I believe that.
Yeah. I mean, let's bring it back to just a government perspective. From all of you guys, you know, we're all in AP government. And one of the basic things that we learned, and quoting our amazing teacher on this, is that, you know, our amazing teacher, if you're watching this, we watch every single one of our episodes. So plug to Mr. Jimenez for that. But he told us, and we've learned this before, the fact that senators and congressmen, people from across the floor, they're checks on the president's power. Because we don't want to have a president, like having a president that can make all the decisions and sway decisions in his or her favor the entire time is an autocracy. It is a monarchy. So I think it's not what we have right now, but ideally we would have congressmen and congresswomen making decisions in their own conscience and in their own moral background. But, you know, you're right, Brad. I have to agree. I think the president wields enormous power on this. And I'm glad that he's coming out with his viewpoints. And as you said before, you know, it wasn't always like that. He didn't always say that. Yeah. But, you know, this time I think that he's come around, and I think that I don't think he thought it was a concern being a constitutionalist, but I think that now he understands that people are quoting him on it, and he has to provide some kind of opinion, which I get. But I wanted to shift it because I think that we spend a while on this. I want to give Brad an elongated chance. I want to let Brad speak for as long as he wants on something. I want you to detail, just because we talked about the Biden debate and the Trump debate, I want you to detail what you liked about the Trump town hall. And I guess we can all go around, but I want you to detail what you liked about it, because sometimes on news sources, we don't get what was necessarily good, because I think that there was some points in which he did bring up some good points, but I want to let you speak on that to give that kind of perspective, Brad.
In all honesty, I watched it in its entirety, and I just didn't enjoy it. I don't know what it was. I think possibly, you know, the hold on.
No worries. I wanted to talk about something.
Yeah,
just a quick point that I wanted to mention. I was gonna say this pushing of kind of the Supreme Court justices to me is something that's so dumb, because it's not helping his political numbers at all, and it's such like a power grab that it's like, it's, you know, I almost see it as like a kamikaze attempt, where it's like a last, like a big F you to the American people before he gets kicked out of office.
One interjection. I mean, you talked about it not helping his poll numbers. In my opinion,
it's hurting them.
If he decided, I think it is, because if he decided to say, you know what, if I become president once again, I'll appoint you, Amy Coney Barrett, to the Supreme Court. You know how invigorated conservatives would be?
Yeah,
they would run to the streets and vote for Donald Trump.
Exactly. Like, John, he could use Kasich, it as like a tease.
Yeah. Mitt Romney is voting for this. John Kasich would vote for Donald Trump if he saw this.
Yeah,
but he's. I don't think it's a good political move, but I know Tarun had something to say. I want him to speak about it.
Yeah, so what I was going to say is, looking back at 2016, I would say like the reason Trump got elected is because of the fact that he was like the anti-establishment Republican, right? He was the one that like everyone considered was like not like a normal politician or whatever. And now that's like that sense, like, you know, that kind of like trait that he had that made him like
appeal.
not anti-establishment is like completely gone now. So that's why I would say like his approval rating has gone down so much, because he became a much more establishment Republican. And another thing I want to add about the town hall is what I noticed with some specific topics. Like let's talk about healthcare, for example. If you see, he was asked by a citizen about what his healthcare plan is going to be, and every single time he's asked about healthcare in like any place, he always responds with an extremely vague answer. Like he just says, oh, we're going to come up with a better healthcare plan. It's the same thing for other things such as like immigration or
we have the best. It's always we have the best. It's we have the best. I have it sitting on my desk right now, ready to sign it if I wanted to.
I want you to have your point first.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So what I feel like he could do to like what he could have done instead of like trying to pack the courts or like just say, oh, we have the best, is like if he actually came out with a couple plans to improve our criminal justice system, a specific healthcare plan, and a specific like or like if he just like had a better corona response, even now, like if he had like if he implemented more government mandates or like send out more stimulus checks to benefit our economy, I feel like that would help him more in the election than just trying to push out this like rhetoric of just not caring about anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, interesting point, Tarun. We're gonna come back with Tarun, Brad, myself, and Damien after a quick advertisement break. Thank you, guys.
All right, we're back from our quick message sponsorship kind of thing that we had there. The break between our two segments. We know a lot of you are joining us once again after you guys took a prolonged break. So just kind of to recap, we talked a little bit about our opinions on what happened during the both respective presidential town halls. We also talked about our opinions on what's happening right now on the Senate floor in respect to the questioning of Amy Coney Barrett. Right now, I think that we're having a very interesting conversation, and we're having a very interesting conversation on something that I think a lot of true Republicans, Lincoln Republicans, have criticized the president for, and something that I think it was the quote that enlightened me the most from the first presidential debate and the only presidential debate so far. It's if Donald Trump would just stop tweeting, he'd be such a better president. And you know, it's his mouth. And someone said the debate were his tweets come to life. And I think Tarun, you were talking about how the fact that he just never says anything. And I said on the first presidential debate, how can someone do so much talking but say so little? And I think that that's kind of the point that you were running on, this fact that he always, you know, he's asked this question. He's like, he can talk about the topic for 5 minutes and you're like, yeah, that wasn't the question that I was asking you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, I want to bring up something, a question. Tarun, go ahead first, actually.
Yeah. Okay. All I was going to say is that, like, you know, Trump is like, I think he's so focused on just the economy, like, that's like the main thing that he keeps pushing. Oh, we created this many jobs with tax cuts and this and that, that he just doesn't care about any other policy that he's asked about. Like almost every single interview or debate that he's in, I've noticed, he's only talking about the economy as like the main benefit of why he should be reelected.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times what he does is he'll just pull something like out of his head and he'll just like say, oh, this much percentage of people wearing a mask like still get corona. Like if he's asking a tough question, he'll just pull out a random statistic without citing any source or anything like that, just so he sounds correct. And a lot of the times he isn't correct.
Yeah.
And I feel like he's just relying on this sort of sense of people thinking that he's right to get reelected.
Absolutely. I want to know, I want to talk about the economy a little bit, but I want to ask Brad, as we kind of turn it towards the economy, do you think that this issue, because it's true, right? This president says we have the, I think the quote that me and Tarun kind of agree on is the president always going like, we have the stats, I'll show them to you. You know, he's like, we have the statistics, and then he'll have right. someone bring him out like some bogus like chart that was made on like Google Docs that was like drawn by like a kindergartner. It was like, see, we have the lowest death rate. It's like, dude, these are like the lowest death rate out of like two countries that are literally impoverished, and like have absolutely no resources to fight coronavirus. And these aren't even like coronavirus death totals. These are just like death totals compared to third world countries. And it's just these obscure facts. But I think that it's because of the fact that he's surrounded by yes men and people that are scared to tell him no. But with that being said, Brad, part of these, this yes men group and this, I would consider it kind of like a sheepish following, almost a cult following, I've heard it referred to, is this big idea with the economy. Brad, what has Donald Trump actually done for the economy?
Well, I mean, if you haven't heard it enough from Donald Trump, you know, the lowest unemployment rates between, you know, blacks, Hispanics.
What policy Asian. Created that?
Honestly, I couldn't tell you. But
ooh, yeah, go ahead.
No. But under the Trump administration, it has been at all-time low unemployment rates, and the economy was at its peak pre-COVID.
And yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, what, yeah. Do you know any policies from the Trump administration that created both the lowest unemployment rate and the peak economy? Like, would you be able to name any?
Honestly, no.
Okay.
I can respond to that.
I think Tarun can respond to that, and I'd like to hear Tarun respond to that.
So what he probably would say is like the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in like 2017, which reduced taxes. And Trump likes to take a lot of credit for that, saying it reduced unemployment and it also like increased the GDP. But if you look at the unemployment trend
yep.
for like the past 10 years, it's down no matter what the presidency is. The president almost has zero control over unemployment. Like, this is like a well-known fact. The only thing that they can do is like help mitigate like how well the economy is running. It's pretty rare that like a president has direct control over unemployment. And because of his tax cuts, I would actually argue that the deficit has increased. Because if you looked at a lot of the graphs which shows deficit, you'll see that under the Trump administration, the deficit's actually gone up quite a bit. So although he might have like kept a good trend with the economy, he increased a lot of deficit for our nation. So I would say that he isn't the best he hasn't had the best economy of any president. I think that's a false claim.
I'm going to jump in here. I would say, thinking back on it, that the, you know, the tax cuts to these big corporations did definitely contribute to the lower unemployment rate, because more companies are obviously drawn to staying in America with these lower taxes, which I do believe creates more jobs.
Right. Now, the issue is that outsourcing is still a pervasive issue. That's the issue, because, you know, outsourcing is almost arguably even more now after, you know, even though we're trying to buy American, outsourcing is pervasive right now. And I think that even the taxes on corporations haven't done much for the economy in and now. But I think that beyond even his regulations, right, we have to go back on the coronavirus stance. You know, opening up businesses is one thing. You know, it stimulates, I guess, what Trump calls the economy. What the president thinks of as the economy is, you know, Nasdaq and Dow Jones, which is the industrial average of the top 50 to 100 companies maximum. The richest companies in the nation make up those things. And I think that the majority of American businesses have crumbled since they've reopened, because the problem is that people don't want to go out. You know, people don't want to leave their homes still. We're still in this quarantine phase. So to say to people, you know, there's no mask mandate, you can go around, no sanitation kind of mandates, and to say we're going to open up these businesses big and loud without these kind of regulations, with Americans dying every single day, it's not going to increase company profits. I'll tell you that. The way in which we do it, in my opinion, is by mandating things like masks, mandating sanitation supplies, and opening up businesses safely so we have people actually shopping at these stores and return the economy to the state it was pre-COVID. And the only way we do that is by giving people the closure they need to attend these businesses. And you can't say, I mean, honestly, you bring up the perspective of having COVID ruining the economy. I think that if you look at European nations, their economies are fairly stable. And the reason why is because they don't have 2,400, 3,000 COVID cases a day. That's the reason why. And it's because—
So let me chime cases, in for a bit. Yeah. So what I completely agree with you, Varun. And I think like a specific plan that Trump could have implemented to mitigate the spread of COVID while also keeping the economy at a pretty stable rate is doing something like where you're required to, you can still go to any business you want, but only a certain amount of people from one household can go out at the same time. And businesses are required to make their employees and required to have any customers coming in wear any masks and be social distance. So I think if he had done that from the get-go, I think we could have severely mitigated the spread of COVID-19. And I think that would have been the best policy to implement.
But what about the Constitution? That's not constitutional. That's, you know, that's not like it says that we want to protect the commonwealth of the nation. Or the common, you know, to be a more prosperous, what is it? It's the quote that says to health, the health of the nation, the health of the people, the individuals within the nation. It's not like it says the preamble or anything, but I'd like to hear Brad respond to that. One thing that I wanted to mention was the fact that if you actually look at the trend of unemployment, Obama era policies actually created a better trend of unemployment. And yesterday the president was here near us. He was in Macomb, Georgia, and I was watching the rally, and this guy comes on and he says, you know, what the Democrats will tell you is that the economy and Donald Trump's economy is because of Joe Biden and Obama. It's like, yeah, that's true. Donald Trump hasn't actually implemented any policies that have boosted the economy. Job creation projections were on the same trend. If Obama had still been in office, if Joe Biden had been in office, if Hillary Clinton had been in office, the unemployment trend was still the exact same, regardless of who had been in office. And I think that this is because of the fact that the fact that Donald Trump takes credit for the economy is the same exact reason that he blamed Bush for 9/11. He's the president, right? So the president has to take any successes and any failures that either plague or define his administration. And if you were going to hold Bush to that standard, would it not be fair? We keep talking about this. If COVID wouldn't have hit, Donald Trump would have had the best economy. Well, if we still look at pre-COVID statistics, Donald Trump's deficit was worse than Obama's. Donald Trump was losing more jobs. I think he lost 250, or he had only created 415,000 manufacturing jobs in his first 4 years, where Obama had created 800,000. And Donald Trump, you know, it's important because Donald Trump promised manufacturing jobs. So again, we kind of resort back to this issue where it's like, what has Donald Trump actually done to the benefit of the nation?
Well, I actually wanted to jump back on, you know, the talk about the deficit, and you guys talked about Trump's, you know, addition to this deficit. But I wanted to say that Obama almost doubled the deficit when he left office. It went from about 10.6 trillion to about 20 trillion. And Trump has had a decent deficit, almost 6 trillion, but you have to account for the fact that of all the COVID relief money. So I don't know if it's, you know, fair to say that Trump just created a way more deficit than Obama did.
Well, to be fair, Obama had to get us out of a recession.
Yeah. But I even think with that, I wish we had a, you know, like how Joe Rogan has like Jamie. We can be like, Jamie, can you fact check that? I always talk about Varun.
I'm fact checking you right now.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at. Okay, well, the thing is, it's difficult to fact check it when we're also trying to have a conversation. So we need to get a Jamie on the podcast. There you go. Jamie. We got Patrick.
Well,
Patrick,
we have Julia. We have Patrick.
Patrick is fact checking that right now, ladies and gentlemen.
You know what? We have Patrick.
We will have a response on the deficit in a couple seconds here. But going on the conversation, again, what is it? Okay. I want to talk about something that's crucial and something that we've avoided. I think, I don't know necessarily that we've avoided it on the podcast, but something that was the foundation of our podcast and we haven't talked about it in a long time.
We have Patrick back. So awesome. go check the channel. So okay. He said the Brad statistics are correct.
Okay. Awesome. So that analysis.
So I want to also I want to also say this because I've done my own fact checking. He's right. He's right. But first of all, Obama was getting us back from a recession, right? And that's very true. And this is talking about the U.S. added $2 trillion between Trump's inauguration and February 11th of this year before the coronavirus. So this is before the virus. And Obama's was $3.46 trillion between his inauguration and February of his last term. And, you know, his recession happened in the beginning of his presidency, whereas Trump's is in the aftermath of it. So right now, it's incredibly larger. And even more than that, you know, President Bush had $676 billion. President Clinton had $617 billion. So it's a lot by any measure. And I think that the reason for why it's a lot is because of failed tariffs on the side of the Trump administration. I think it's definitely because of some failed tariffs and some ineffective taxes. And I think this is why we have the kind of deficit that we have. It's ineffective economic decisions. And I think that, you know, when you look at the conglomerate, everything together, you're going to see after this year that the deficit under President Trump is going to be skyrocketing and staggeringly high, higher than President Obama's. And that's because the recession happened at the end of his presidency, whereas Obama's happened at the beginning. So obviously it's going to be higher up till this point.
Yeah, so I'd like to add on. So yeah, a lot of the times people say like Trump's tax cuts, like because of like trickle-down economics, it created jobs and increased wages. But like there's been multiple studies which show that there's the correlation coefficient between cutting the top tax rate on individuals and increased economic growth, wages, and job growth is actually very minimal. So I would say that tax cuts don't necessarily directly help the middle class as much as he claims they did.
Yeah, absolutely.
And well, I do want to chime in about, you know, Trump's impact on the economy. Back when Obama was in administration, and it was during a recession, the median household income or the median home price, the value was about $171,000, and in 2020. Before COVID, it jumped all the way up to 300,000. So Trump did have a massive impact on the median home value.
Then again, the average household got $16,000 more expensive since he won, on the other hand.
And on top of that, I wouldn't particularly argue that that's a good thing for the shrinking middle class that is now becoming the low class if you're having homes become more expensive. You're also having homes become more expensive while wages aren't rising. So it's this thing where, go on.
Well, wages actually are rising because the median household income has increased significantly. From 2012, it was 55,000 and it is now 60,000.
I was going to say this in respect to the median household. I have looked at the statistic that doesn't reflect accurately the actual Well, the issue is that the rich again are getting richer. So if you're going to have more money circulating again, if you combine mine and Jeff Bezos' net worth, and we say that our mean net worth between the both of us is what, $100 trillion? Yeah, that's because I have zero. That's because I have nothing. I don't have any net worth, right? So to say that I have $100 trillion worth of net worth would be completely unfair and would overshoot myself.
I think that the bigger argument here, and I know I kind of interjected you, Damien, I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
The bigger argument here is that yes, Brad, the household income is increasing. So are costs of housing. So are costs of healthcare. So are costs of childcare. And so are costs of college. That's the reality of it. And that's why we have to, I believe the progressive change is needed. Because it's not an accurate estimate of how much of Americans are paying for these essential services. And I think that when you're looking at how Medicaid and Medicare have been litigated and have been tried to be litigated in the past, the whole basis of the current litigation against Medicare is to give tax breaks to the top 1% of people. And they're saying we're going to save Americans billions of dollars. That saves the top percent billions of dollars. And I just think it's unfair to the American people to give tax cuts to the top 1% while restricting the American people from 20 million people from healthcare. And that's the cost of it. Circumstance, yes, the median household income might increase, but so will the cost of healthcare and so will the plight of the American people. And that's what I want to hit on.
Yeah, so I want to talk about two things, the cost of healthcare and the cost of college. So right now, the cost of college has gone up 55% in the past decade, right? And I guarantee you, like, a lot of these costs, like, associated with college, associated with, like, our healthcare market, are reflected upon the housing price. Because, like, because of the fact that everything else is getting more expensive, inflation is going up, and the fact that you didn't account for wealth inequality, I would actually say that the standard of living didn't necessarily go up as much as you think it went up. So that's, like, the main thing I wanted to say.
Yeah. I wanted to kind of switch the topic here because we could argue.
Let's let Brad respond.
Yeah, do you want to respond? Absolutely. Do you want to respond?
No.
Okay, awesome. So the only thing that I wanted to switch the topic, I was going to switch the topic to this earlier. And I like going with natural transitions. So I guess the natural transition would be like talking about something that's costly. Let me try to make this. Talking about something that's costly, let's talk about the cost of an African-American human life. With respect to, I can't make this transition. But let's talk about race relations in the country.
You know, this was the trouble I had at the beginning of the podcast. Back in June, I was like, how do I connect things?
Yeah,
and a lot of times it became.
I think the thing is that sometimes we try to make these smooth like segues where it's like honestly, if we just like said what we were saying. Either way, regardless, I talk about like a really chopped up and speed bump. We just hit like 8 speed bumps there. Nonetheless. We can't. It's the trifecta, right? It's the economy, race relations, and COVID, and some might argue that they're all intermingled, especially the economy and COVID. But we can't deny that race relations under the Trump administration have plummeted. I want to talk to you specifically because I've seen this. I've seen the Breonna Taylor case come up more and more. So we're about to talk about some fun stuff. We're about to talk about your Second Amendment rights and race relations. So let's see how many viewers we lose. Let's look at our at our stats after we
start talking. Our guys. We have like 10 people tuning in now. So
yeah.
If you are listening, thank you for being a soldier. We've been having some amazing conversations. I think this is probably our best run. But yeah, go ahead, Damien.
Yeah, absolutely. What I was going to say, though, is the race relations, right? This stark contrast in how we just receive people. I want to talk about QAnon, and I think that Tarun wanted to talk a little bit about it. The way that it was prefaced to Trump, I feel like it was almost a compliment in the town hall. So this is how I want to open it up, but I want to talk about definitely about Breonna Taylor later and about, you know, her boyfriend's second use or right of the Second Amendment, use of the Second Amendment. There you go. Got it out. But let's open up with the two things, which are, I guess, parallel in a sense. The fact that he could not denounce white supremacy, the first debate, and the fact that he could not denounce QAnon at the second debate. So, Brad, why? I've heard, you know, you responded to us on Twitter with 7 instances where Donald Trump did denounce white supremacy, most of which were teleprompted, and even more so. I think that anytime the fact that I just hear the white supremacy, the word white supremacy, and I just go bad. So like it should just almost be an instinct to say. It's like going Hitler and going like, no, no, no. And then once I'm going like, I don't know, maybe Hitler wasn't such a bad guy, right? It's like there has to be a consistency there. So right. What happened? Why can't we just say no to white supremacy?
I believe in the first debate, Trump tried to, but then he kind of just went off on his own tangent just to address Antifa. But he did denounce it after. In a Fox interview, and then he did again denounce it in the town hall. But bringing up QAnon, you know, Trump openly stated to the moderator that he just did not know too much about them, and all he knew was, you know, they were against pedophilia. And I personally, I can't say I know much about them at all either. So, you know, if Trump truly did not know much about the organization, then I don't think, you know, he should have to, you know, make an opinion on it or a statement on it.
Let's put this into perspective.
Add on. Oh.
Yeah, no, Tarun, I wanted to hear. I think all of our brains, me, I just Tarun, and Brun's brain.
I really want to get something out of here.
We went retweet.
Say a single sentence.
Go for it.
Yeah, I just want to say a single little.
All right.
I'll just.
Oh, you noticed in the town hall, right? The moderator told him exactly what going on was, right? He's right. Like, yeah. it's a conspiracy theory, which basically states
that you're the Messiah.
That like everything is run by like a deep state of satanic pedophiles that are plotting against Donald Trump, right? And I think Donald Trump was just playing stupid during the thing. And he was like, oh yeah, I don't know about them, so I can't denounce them. And I thought that was
oh my God.
You know what? You know what happened? Yeah. So do you know what I think?
Dumb. This is so how is stupid.
How is it that – can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes, we can.
Okay. So my question is, how is it the president knows enough about it – enough about QAnon to say they denounce pedophilia but doesn't know enough to denounce – you know, he endorsed one of their candidates, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is a member of QAnon, been asked – timeless count time after time after time. Don't you think one of these times he would have researched and been like, you know what, Kayleigh McKinney, what the hell is QAnon?
There's don't an you issue. Think he asked that you said the word Taylor. Research though.
No, I think that, you know, if he's endorsing a member of QAnon named Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, it's important for him to know exactly what he's endorsing. So I think that it speaks. But number one, I want to bring in this. On the town hall itself, the moderator, Savannah Guthrie, questioned him on a tweet where he reposted a tweet about how Obama faked the whole Osama bin Laden assassination and they got the wrong guy. And she's, you know, he tweeted a tweet about that, a conspiracy theory. Now, I want to speak about this. Savannah Guthrie said that she asked, why did you retweet that? And he said, well, it is a retweet. You know, it doesn't mean I support it. I just have to, you know, give the facts to the American people and let them make a judgment. Now,
dude,
that's the line that Fox News uses, right? That's Fox News' go-to line, giving the facts, not providing judgment. However, that's a conspiracy theory.
Can we just say that this guy's an idiot? Like, I think that we can, like...
I don't think we can agree on that. Brad, go ahead. There we go. Time to shine.
Okay, listen. I don't know what Trump was thinking about the QAnon thing, but... listen,
bro. You and his press secretary are so good. I think that all Trump supporters are like equally qualified to be his press secretary. That's not what the president meant.
No, Brad. You have a very hard job. Brad, you do a very good job. I'll give you that.
Dude, his press secretary is so talented. But nonetheless, go on, Brad.
She is really good. No, but like I honestly have no idea what he was doing there. You know, even if he was to say, I denounce QAnon, he's not going to lose those supporters. I'm not sure at all what he was doing there.
I think it's like if someone came up to me and they were like, do you know what, I'm just going to make up three random letters that I see on my keyboard. Do you know what TYP is? And I was like, no. And they were like, well, it's this group that eats like, stolen, I don't know, like food, stolen food from homeless kids. And they were like, do you denounce them? I was like, I don't know. It's like,
yeah,
like
I don't know enough about them, you know?
Listen, I mean, you know, Trump has been.
I want to know where you're defending.
I say Trump has not been on the good side of the media. So he obviously did not trust her enough. But then again, he could have easily just been like, no. Like, no, I don't support them. I condemn them.
Or I deny them. It's funny that he never researches it or never even asks about it because he's been asked by countless people about QAnon, right? He, like I said before, he endorsed the candidate, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's a member of QAnon. But I wanted to talk about the consequences of this, guys. We saw today at the Trump rally, Brad, you were going to go to it. I remember. Brad even asked me if I wanted to go to it.
I wanted to go to it.
You guys know my response. I was going to go to it. Wear a Biden mask.
Why didn't you get in some? No, you would have been.
I was.
That's not the.
Say it, Brad. Say it.
No.
You would have been what? What?
All right. Let's go back to the point here, guys. I want to talk about hate crimes in America. Ever since, you know, Trump
got elected.
Now, when you're looking at hate crimes in America, you have to consider that you know, back under Bush and back under the past two presidents, not a single case of hate crime or violence was associated with the name Bush or Obama. Whereas under President Trump, we've had over 54 cases of violence invoking Trump, with violence, threats, and alleged assault. We had a Latino gas attendant pushed by a white man who had last said, "This is for Trump." We had three Kansan men on trial for planning to bomb a largely Muslim apartment complex and saying their other attorney was saying it was a long and ignored white working voters, you know, created by Trump. And so many cases of hail Trump because of this. And I, you know, I'm looking back on my notes. This is the first set of notes that I had. I had the name for Politine, everything, all the ideas, the origin story for Politine. And I see this and I'm like, this is something that we've been talking about for a long time. And I want to talk about this today. The rally itself, the reason why I mentioned it is because today we saw David Perdue. He came out and he spoke to supporters of President Trump. And he said, well, you know, this Kamala, whatever, right? And people didn't consider that as a big thing. But that was a microaggression. That was a microaggression. And I want to talk about what things like that and what things like the China virus and things like that have an impact upon, you know, hate crimes.
I wouldn't say that I am qualified to speak on the sense of microaggressions. I'm not, I find myself hardly offended by anything. I think that there's certain things that are just blatantly wrong and racist. I think that David Perdue is just genuinely not necessarily, how do I put this kindly?
You can't.
He's not the brightest man in the race for anything. I think that it's just, I mean, listen, if we're going to be honest, I think it's, I don't ever want to defend something that could be seen as racist, but I think it's just old white dudes being old white dudes. And it was a bunch of old white dudes just hyping each other up. And they were like, hey, that's kind of funny. And like other people can be like, hey, that's kind of racist. And they're like, yeah, that's why it's funny. But like, I mean, that's all I can really say about it. It's just a bunch of white dudes hanging out, old white dudes.
I kind of agree with whatever Damien said. I didn't watch the rally. I wasn't able to, but I think it's, the rally is also for entertainment purposes, and you know, he's probably just making a joke, trying to get, you know, enthusiasm out of the crowd. So I don't really think there was, you know, much there, in my opinion.
You know what? I want to say this. As an Indian American, you know, me and Turner are both Indian Americans. Kamala means lotus. Kamala means lotus.
Yes.
And when you change the meaning of a word which was given by her parents to mean lotus, the symbol of who she is, when you change that, it is an offense. I know it because I've lived it. I live it every single day. I have been called different names in my past, and that's the whole reason for why my name is spelled with two O's. It's spelled with two O's because my mom didn't want people calling me Veyron. That's why my name is spelled the way it is. So I am, I'm living through those kinds of things, and changing somebody's name just to poke fun at a rally may seem like funny at the instance, but at the deep root of it, it gives people the vindication to think of these people as different because we have different names. And that's the reality of it. We have to accept these names for what they are. And when Kamala Harris says, my name is Kamala, it's not Kamala, it's not Kamalalala, my name is Kamala, you have to respect that as an American.
And yeah, Varun, piggybacking off of what you said, I've been called Tarun countless amount of times. Yeah. People have mispronounced my name so many times. And I think that's pretty sad, honestly. Like, it's not their fault a lot of the times, but if it is on purpose, then yes, I would agree. It's a microaggression and should be treated as racist.
You know what it is, Sharon? You know what it is? When it's not their fault usually, right? Mm-hmm. And when you tell them my name is Varun, they consider that. They're just like, they never call you Veyron again. Never call you Tehran again or something like that, right? They call you by your name. Now, the problem here is that Kamala Harris is a well-known figure. They know how to pronounce her name. They're not saying it because they don't know. And they never learn from it. I'm telling you that. Trump pronounced her name wrong two times consecutively, continues to. He's doing it on purpose. It's doing it on purpose. And it just hurts me inside.
You want to know something that I guess now that I see that from, you know, and obviously that's why we kind of come on the podcast and talk about perspective. Because I guess me and Brad have really never had the circle. I've had my name spelled wrong. I think that's the worst that has like ever happened to me. I've been called Daniel, but and Damon.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. Daniel. Some people. I'd be like that. That's not just ignorant. I think that's just I think that's a reflection of the horrible education system that we have in America. But no, nonetheless, like I think that me and Brad have never really experienced that side of it. And kind of when you mentioned that, and we get to see it from that perspective, it's true. And I think that this goes on to another issue. I think that this kind of goes on to kind of the issue of like what people identify as with their gender or who they want to identify as. And I have this perspective. If Rune, if you wanted me to pronounce your name like literally any other way, I don't get the issue with just pronouncing it that way. Right? Let's say your name was spelled with a K instead of a V and you were like, no, it's Varun. I'd be like, okay, then it's Varun. You know, I don't understand the issue with just complying to something so simple. And beyond that, I mean, it's so childish. This is a United States senator. A senator, right? Something that only
And running for re-election.
Exactly. Something that only a few...
Hold up. Running for re-election, I'm going to say this. With an increasingly brown population voting in this election.
That's what I was going to say. Only a few people have ever had the privilege of being a senator, and to be disrespected like that because of your background, because you are an Indian American, is not only disrespectful to you as an individual. First of all, it's disrespectful to your constituents that circled, you know, your name on the ballot, that checked rather your name on the ballot, right? They knew how to say your name. They knew how to say Kamala Harris. They knew who they were voting for. So first and foremost, it's disrespectful to your constituents back in California. Second of all, I think that now it's also disrespectful to, you know, not only, I would argue, not only Indian and Asian Americans. I think Asian Americans are probably most inclined to have their name pronounced in racist ways or in micro. I think specifically like Chinese and Japanese people would probably suffer from it more. I think with different parts of Asia, it's genuine dispronunciation. But I think that right now with the China virus and stuff, that there is like a genuine racist pronunciation of names and such going on. But you kind of disregard the other, and it does become this sense of us versus them, which we see polarizing America right now. And I think it goes with anyone that's black and brown, because I know, you know, black people also have unique names and names that have history and have culture and have, you know, deep roots. Like, I didn't know that it meant Lotus. Hell, I don't even necessarily know what Lotus means. But, you know, if it's something that's important to that culture, I don't see why we're going to disrespect it like that. But I love to hear Brad's perspective on it because, you know, I know that I think that we can talk a little bit more about the gender kind of side of it. Like, why can't we just, if someone wants to be called a damn toaster, is that transphobic?
Actually, I have a very interesting perspective on gender.
Yeah, regardless, if someone wants to be called, I don't know, because I know that some people consider it, like, when you make like an extreme exaggeration of gender, they consider it transphobic. But if someone wants to be called Z, I know that one's one. If someone wants to be called, you know, their gender wants to be referred to as Z, like, what's the issue with calling them by their pronouns or being called, you know, whatever they want? But I'd love to hear Brad's interpretation of kind of just this in circumstance after we've been kind of informed by both Tarun and Varun.
So wait, am I going first?
Yeah, go ahead. Go first. Okay, yeah. I think we lost Brad.
I actually would consider myself a gender abolitionist. Like, I don't think gender should exist. Like, I agree, people should be able to identify as whatever they want. And that's why I think gender shouldn't exist, because I want like everyone to be treated equally and just engage with who they want to engage with, if you know what I mean. Like, yeah. I don't understand why people can't be called whatever they want to be called or be treated how they want to be treated, as a woman or a man or non-binary or whatever they want to identify as. And I think that's completely their decision to make. And yeah, I don't think they should be discriminated against for it.
Absolutely. You know, it was interesting because I was talking to someone earlier today that I knew in middle school, and I guess this is more in relation to sexuality, but they were lesbian. And since then, I guess they've had a change in sexuality. And I have this person on social media. So I've seen the fact that they've been in two long-term relationships with guys. And only today I realized the fact that she wasn't lesbian anymore. And I was like, the thing is, she was referred to as like the lesbian girl in our middle school. Not necessarily in a mean way by some people. By some people, it most definitely was in a mean way. But just because of the fact that we had a lack of diversity in our school, she was known primarily because of the fact that she was lesbian. So it was interesting where I could kind of just be like, okay, like, cool, she's dating a guy, she's dating a girl. I mean, who cares? And I think the gender conversation is something that we could go on for like another 40 minutes about. Because I know that different cultures even have different kind of perspectives on gender as a whole. Yeah. I know that specifically Indian culture, in
Hinduism.
Yeah, Hinduism has, if I'm not mistaken, there's transgenders. There's a combination of I think it's Shiva and I can't remember the other one, that the other god that they both, like, when they're combined,
it's okay, Damien, there's like a thousand of them.
Yeah, no, yeah. no, but there was two gods, because I love kind of just the setting of, I'm not going to major in gender studies by any means, but I kind of love studying different cultures. And I think that so I was talking to a friend about it, and I want to hear Brad's perspective again about just being able to not just say someone's name or gender or whatever, but I was talking to a friend about it. And basically the conversation was, she posted on her story, she was like, I'm tired of people, like, there's only two genders, it's male and female. And I was like, no, like, there, you know, like, who cares? Like, sure, there's only, because what a gender is a specific societal role, right? If I'm not mistaken, sexuality is different.
Social construct.
Yeah, I think gender is a social construct. Now, sex is a binary fact.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, who cares? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say who cares, right? When you're talking about binary fact, that's getting into a dicey area. I have a more formulated opinion.
In the scientific and like sociological community, gender is accepted as a social construct.
Yeah, no. Gender is most definitely
a spectrum.
Yeah, sex. I think can be more argued upon.
I would say sex binary, because every single like other sex, like XXY, is a mutation. And I'd say sex is determined by your karyotype. So if you have like the SRY gene to produce sperm and other gene to produce eggs, you're just male or female.
Yeah,
I just say it's based on mutation.
Go ahead.
I say this, guys. I say normalize the unnormal. As long as the unnormal doesn't affect you.
Exactly.
As long as the unnormal doesn't affect you, normalize it. Because I think it is good to have diversity. You know, the right always talks about having Democrats trying to, you know, homogenize the black populations, make them think a certain way. I want everybody to have their own voice. I've never thought of a person as, you know, bad, or, you know, I never thought of them as the worst person if they're Republican or they're a Trump supporter. I think, you know, my personal viewpoint, and you guys can disagree with this, is that if a person supports President Trump, he or she is misled.
Yeah.
He's a product of the system. That's what I believe.
Yeah.
And I love them for who they are, for one reason and one reason alone. Because even though, in my opinion, they are a part of the system, they try to make their voice heard.
Mm-hmm.
And they undoubtedly care about this country.
You know, I want to say one thing just quickly. I think I hate one thing. And it's this that wave of kind of Trump supporters referring to themselves as the silent majority. I made a joke and it was like, they say that they're the silent majority, but I just hear them everywhere. You know, they're not so silent. And I think that they're the loud minority.
I mean, no, I get it though. Actually, I get it. I mean, Brad, I want to hear your perspective.
Yeah,
I get
absolutely.
It.
Do you consider yourself the loud minority or the silent majority, Brad?
You see, I guess it depends where you are, right?
In America.
So I see that too, or like where you're looking. Like, let's say I go on Twitter.
Okay.
You know, you look at trending, and almost none of the time it's going to be like, it's mostly against Trump, right? And then that would make them quiet. They're not loud, right? But you see them maybe in person or, you know, in other places, then you could say they're the loud minority.
Do you think they're louder when they have supporters around them? Because I think that what I believe is that Republicans are undoubtedly louder when they have an echo chamber around them. And when, for example, President Trump's on Fox News, never receives a single type of feedback or criticism from the anchors, never asked to go in depth. I think that Republicans, in my opinion, not just Republicans, but Trump supporters, they're caught in a really back and forth in which they have to back out in many circumstances on platforms like Twitter, which is why they like participating in places where they can have an echo chamber. Because it's hard. It's really hard, Brad. I want to say this. Vice President Mike Pence does an incredible job at defending the president because he doesn't have a lot to go off of. The president himself doesn't have a lot to go off of in defending himself as a person. So where he does this is in echo chambers like Fox News and things like that. That's why, you know, he never goes on CNN or things like this because he gets killed every single time. If you've noticed, it's a pattern of him getting pummeled every single time he's given anything but an echo chamber. And it's even on an echo chamber. I mean, Fox News even pummels him. They don't even do talking. He kills himself in the polls going on Fox News.
You know what's the funniest thing? It's watching him kill himself and the Fox News anchors try to save it. It's like, well, right, well, what you mean by that, right, Mr. President, is obviously.
He publicly said that he doesn't like Fox News and he endorsed like this other like
super far right. It's called the conservative. It's the Conservative American Network. Something like that. That's where it airs.
It literally, it's similar to like Breitbart and those kind of.
It's literally, it's like, and then like all the ads that air on there are like NRA ads. It's like the NRA channel, which I think everyone should have guns. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, and there's like a couple of things I just wanted. I think we should hear Brad's take and then we can move
on to
like
I was going to say.
Systemic racism and criminal justice.
So a lot.
I want to talk about criminal justice.
So what exactly do you want to hear my take on?
Why do you support Trump?
No, I don't want to. I don't want to hear that.
I was kidding. Okay. I was kidding.
I want to hear this. Do you agree with my standpoint? What do you think about my standpoint about having Trump supporters don't like to go out there and like to be a silent majority because when they're loud, they receive feedback. And when they're in their silent echo chambers, they just get what they want.
Well, I think that's just anyone, right? When you're around people who support you and, you know, they have a common goal or you share common values, you're more likely to be more, you know, confident and I guess loud. But you know, it's not just Trump supporters. You know, it can be anyone.
Yeah, I mean,
in my opinion,
I want to cut back. I want you to continue. Actually, I wanted to ask you something on what you said. Are you done with what you're saying, or do you want to continue?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask you. I mean, honestly, for all of you guys, Brad mentioned common goals and common values. I think that we all have common goals and common values, and we overlook that way too often. Because I'll be talking to conservatives, and we'll just be talking about, besides the politics of it, what we see for this nation, and a lot of times it's very similar, right? We all want what's best for our families. We all want what's best for our people. Except sometimes it's at the cost of, for example, our environment. For conservatives, it's for unborn babies. There's different types of seeing it, but the root cause is that we're all trying to become a better nation, better people, and better Americans. And once we figure that out, I think that's the number one thing for compromise.
Yeah, can we talk about abortion? Can four guys talk about abortion, or are we gonna?
Absolutely not.
I'm just gonna go on a moral tangent.
Okay. Well, no. I want to talk because I think that it's extremely crucial, and I think that even male perspective on the issue is something that how do I phrase this without getting canceled?
Maybe
we're important.
Missing.
I think no. I don't think that male.
I revoked that. I said we're missing it. No, we're not missing it. Males speak for women's abortion.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, every single
exactly.
Day.
Exactly. I just want to. I want to offer my opinion independently of speaking for females. And I think that with respect to that, that next time we should definitely have a female joining our conversation. We have had females join our conversation, but I want to have a conversation about abortion with a female in the near future, on the podcast. But nonetheless, I want to talk about something. I want to talk about this idea of just more so than abortion, pro-life versus pro-choice, which I know relates to abortion, but I think it's those mindsets that I want to talk about more so than the actual abortion process, and whether that's death or whether, you know, a woman, blah, 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 and you know, whatever, I guess, that aspect, that root of a woman actually making a decision with her body. Brad, are you pro-life or pro-choice?
If I was asked that question, I would say pro-life.
Okay, and Varun, I've gathered a mixed response from you. I've heard like pro-life or what would you consider yourself?
I'm pro-choice because of Nick Cama Williams.
Okay, Tarun, what would you consider yourself?
I'm pro-choice.
Okay, the thing is, I think that I'm pro-choice, but I'm pro-life. Like if that makes sense. Yeah,
you're pro-choice for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Like
you're pro-life for yourself.
But like that's like the most American thing, right? I feel like giving people the decision whether they want to have an abortion or not have an abortion is what being pro-choice is more so than it's. I think some people look at pro-choice as pro-abortion, which is not necessarily the case. And one statistic that I wanted to look at is something that I found very interesting, where it's when abortion is made illegal, a similar amount of deaths will happen, or a rising amount of deaths. I wouldn't say similar at all. I revoke that statement. But more women die because of illegal abortions. So when you have, for example, you had, what was it? It was 20 million legal abortions, and you had 20 million illegal abortions throughout the world. I don't remember necessarily what year it was or whether it was the world, but it was 20 million versus, 20 million illegal. And then when you legalize them, you had, you know, zero illegal abortions. But you had 30 million legal ones. So it's that rate that dropped, and you have these deaths dropping. So wouldn't it almost be fair to say that being pro-life or being pro-choice is being pro-life?
Well, I honestly, like you said earlier in your group chat, I think we're just really bad at naming things.
Yeah. Like,
yeah. So I feel like pro-life, it should just be renamed to something like, we have these names, in my opinion, just for like connotation reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like pro-life should just be anti-abortion, and you know,
well, that's what it is.
Yeah, it is. And pro-choice, I feel yeah. So I think pro-choice, if when you hear someone say pro-choice, I know a lot of people will automatically assume they're, you know, for abortion. So I'm kind of contradicted here.
Honestly, I disagree.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think pro-choice means pro-abortion. Go ahead, Brian.
I think it's pretty clear, to be honest. I mean, pro-life means that you don't support abortions. Pro-choice means you support choice, and the choice between an abortion and not getting one.
There's like a lot of reasons why I'm pro-choice. It's not just because of like. I agree with what Damien said about how abortions decrease, but like reason why I'm pro-choice is because of like philosophical reasons. So like for me, bodily autonomy still applies even if the fetus is alive. So I don't think you can grant moral consideration to a fetus that doesn't have the ability to like process information in its brain, because or have a conscience, you know what I mean?
Because, yeah, it's like, how we treat
functionally,
how we treat people in life
functionally
support.
The fetus is like an equivalent to like an ant,
uh-huh.
Right, and or like a chicken or something like that, right? And obviously Brad eats meat, so he wouldn't grant moral consideration to a chicken. So I would say that philosophically as well, a fetus shouldn't be valued at such a high standard to where you're like, oh, you're killing a human life every time you abort a baby. So that's why I think the bodily autonomy argument still applies, and it's still your body, even though a lot of people say it's a separate body.
You bring up that, you know, that argument about chicken, but I mean, I think it's like we all can agree that, you know, it's fundamental to, you know, there's other options for food, but it is a necessity to get food, and by doing that you would have to kill a chicken. But it's, I feel, the complete opposite to kill, you know, an unborn baby. I think there's just no need.
Are you valuing one necessity. Life over another, Brad?
Damien, you're being a little bit boomy.
Sorry.
You're
am I?
A little bit boomy. Yeah.
Well, you want to put it like that, then yeah, I would value.
Oh yeah.
Be careful! No, no, no! Just don't go down that. Don't go down that rabbit hole.
Chickens.
Okay, no. But Brad, why what characteristic makes you value human life more than another life when it's a fetus below the third trimester?
What do you mean?
Like, yeah, go ahead.
What specific characteristics makes it unique enough where you can say that killing one is wrong, but killing the other isn't wrong?
Well, because in my opinion, you know, the unborn baby below or before the third trimester is going to be a human. And, you know, going back to the chicken, it's, you know, it's already alive, you know?
If you're going to talk about like potential or capacity, any type of sperm cell has the capacity to become a human.
Well, it's not even reached. You talk about a sperm. A bit, you know, I believe life is created at conception, right? But, the egg and the sperm, they have to meet, you know. Birds and the bees, Damien.
Yes.
So that you know is what? How...
Go.
I get what you're saying, Brad. I get it.
I want to know, so then what's your perspective? Go ahead.
I get what Brad is saying. What I don't get is why, like you said, we don't have options. Because if we were to not abort babies, in the case of anything, and I believe this, anything but rape, incest, a mother's life, if we were to not allow abortions in these circumstances, besides those three, where is the option? Is there adoption centers? Because right now, our adoption center is crippling. You know, our whole system is crippling right now. There is no option. And I believe that fully. I think Brad makes up, I mean, it seems like a flawed point, but I think that it's a decent point because,
I agree.
I mean, morally, I think that we all have some kind of a tendency towards valuing human life over some animal life. And with sperm as well, I think it's some kind of inherent moral tendency of Americans. I can't say as much for our president valuing the lives of, you know, American people. But anyways, that's another topic. I want to talk about the fact that we don't have a good adoption system, right? I think that when you're starting to talk about, you know, banning abortions in certain circumstances, you have to first talking about improving the adoption system. And when we get on that track, then I think maybe I'll be able to make the shift towards conditional banning of abortions.
Yeah.
Agree with that, Varun.
Yeah, I agree with that thing. As well.
Oh, okay, wait.
No, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. All I was going to say is like the majority of unplanned pregnancies are born into like low socioeconomic conditions. Yeah. So they're born poor. And people who go into foster care, around 1 in 6 of the people who go into foster care are like sexually abused. So if we just put like these adopted kids into the current system, right, then there's a huge likelihood that they're not going to turn out that well. So I think not only because I don't grant moral consideration to a life, but also because of the fact I think it would be more beneficial to society in general if we give women the choice and access to abortions whenever they want to have.
Yeah,
them.
I think
access. I just want to ask, I want to ask a woman on the podcast when they come on. I mean, it's a hard question, but like Tarun said, a lot of people who go to adoption centers and foster care centers are sexually abused. So what do you prefer for your child? A sexually abusive experience or, you know, abortion at the, you know, I guess what Tarun said, in the sperm stage, right? With no consciousness whatsoever. Yeah.
But Vern, I wholeheartedly believe if you ask anyone who was going to be aborted, I would say at least 99% of them would say they are glad they were not aborted, even if they were in the adoption system and even if they went through struggles in life. I can almost guarantee you that they would say, I'm glad I'm not dead right now.
I think that that's a hypothetical statistic, and I wouldn't necessarily attest to that. I think that you'd have to ask them at a certain point in their life. But I always compare it to life support and how, like, we give the consent to life to, like, whoever would be considered appropriate when someone's brain dead, right? So, like, why do we treat people who are brain dead? We're just like, you want to pull the plug or not? But, like, when it's, like, a fetus that is brain dead, I think that we can all agree that a fetus is brain dead. I mean, it's not...
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
It has
like,
no sentience.
Yeah, it doesn't. If you talk to a fetus, it's not going to be like, yeah, I had a good day too. It's the same thing if you talk to a brain dead person. You know, they're not going to be able to respond to you. So what's the distinction there? Is it the potential?
There is no distinction, and here's why, in my opinion.
Go for it.
Because of the fact that a brain-dead individual can't make their own decisions anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So that means their autonomy is passed to another individual, like a legal guardian or something like that, right? Just like that, in a fetus, right? They're not a fetus isn't capable of making their own decisions. So that means the mother holds the autonomy, and that's what I would say.
I think it's an interesting perspective. I think that it was an amazing conversation, a conversation that I would love to carry on any day. You know, I anytime that we start talking about abortion, the first person that always comes to mind for some reason is Ben Shapiro. It's always just the stuttering patterns of Ben Shapiro that always get me. He's like, well, if you really want to consider it from a different perspective, it's just it gets so.
That was an amazing imitation.
The one person Damien has to learn is Donald Trump.
I don't even think Donald Trump can do Donald Trump. If you really ask him to. No, he does it a different style every single day.
I don't think Damien would want to do Donald Trump.
I kind of want to touch the topic of criminal justice, but I don't know if we'll have time.
I don't think
we will discuss it on another episode.
I think that we should come and have a bonus episode. I think that we've been lacking on having our bonus episodes, and you can find our bonus episodes if we ever choose to really get on task with them at Patreon. But we really do recommend that you guys go and check out our Patreon, because there's many cool benefits besides the bonus episodes that we're going to be uploading on there. You guys have access to our Discord server, and you will be able to engage with us more frequently and more closely. So be sure to definitely check out our Patreon. It does support
us. One more thing.
Go for it.
If you did stay until 1 hour and 35 minutes coming on to now, I would say go try to donate to our toy drive. We have a lot of support. I know Brad pitched in as well. So it's amazing what we're doing for the kids in our community who are underprivileged with the whole COVID situation going on. It's really important. Because kids are really suffering. We want to bring that joy that we have for our entire lives and take for granted. So make sure to check it out. It's on our website, our Twitter, our social media platforms, at Political Teen Show. Go follow us. Go connect with us. But that said, we're closing this out from our four Political Teen studios in Brad's house, my house, Damien's house, and Karun's house. 2:53 a.m. for us in Atlanta. But peace out, guys. Wherever the hell you are.
Thank you, guys.
We've seen viewers from
Germany. Thank you guys for...
Hey, I just want to say this. A big plug to our German people, because they're increasing by the day. We have a lot of German people coming in.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. All the Germans checking us out. I think that peep the Germans that agree with our viewpoints. But with that being said, thank you guys so much for tuning in. I think that it was an amazing episode. I want to thank all of our guests finally for being our first ever four guest panel on the podcast. There was some kinks in the system. We worked around some stuff, but at the end of the day, we had a conversation, and that's what is most important, ladies and gentlemen. And that's what we invite all of you to do. Go out and have a conversation. This was by no means an argument. And I think that at no point, anyone really felt like it was an argument. I think that this was in every sense a discussion, and that's, you know, really important. I learned something, you know, I learned the importance of being able to pronounce someone's name correctly and what that really means to them, something that I hadn't considered before. And that's really what having these conversations can do. They can offer you perspective onto different people's perspectives. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, once again, I want to thank my wonderful co-host Varun for having insightful questions and really driving the conversation that we had today. And I want to thank all of you for tuning into another episode of Politity, and be sure to tune in this Friday. We're going to have another amazing episode for all of you to watch. And with that being said, goodbye.
All right.
Hello, 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 everybody. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Politician Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/politicianpodcast for more exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. That is, once again, www.patreon.com/politicianpodcast. I'm going to make it a jingle when I grow up. It is www.patreon.com/politicianpodcast. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. But definitely visit www.politicianpodcast.com. For more amazing content from myself, Damien, our team, our amazing artwork head, and our sponsors over at Polititeen. And once again, thank you so much for watching today's episode. Thank you to my co-host, Damien Galvin, for an amazing conversation, my friend. I do appreciate your input, as always. And that said, have a great rest of your weekend. Chime in for the next episode, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation.